Okay, here we go. Stand by. 3, 2, 1, action.
Assume nothing.
Rash, bald-faced blasphemy.
Question everything.
I find it extremely hard to imagine.
Open your eyes.
It is quite all right to be an atheist.
The fastest growing group of people in the country has been measured as being those who have no belief or who are atheists.
You don't have to be apologetic or quiet about it.
Challenge the opposition.
You see religion on 100 fronts losing the argument.
And start thinking. This is The Thinking Atheist Worldwide.
Next Tuesday night is our annual Halloween tradition. It is ghost stories. Love this time of year. I love the month of October. I love Halloween. It's my favorite holiday, and I love doing the ghost story show. I know many of our listeners agree. So next Tuesday night, make a date to join me on the radio. We'll lower the lights, we'll crank up the sound, and we will sit around the virtual campfire together. Ed Suominen, who's written some original work for this broadcast in the past, he's done a piece, a story, just for next Tuesday. I will cap the broadcast with an original ghost story once again. And we're just going to have fun. We're going to enjoy the Halloween holiday together. Tonight's broadcast is called Health, Wootrition, and the Food Babe. And the show essentially is kind of a three-part thing. I'm going to start the show with a conversation with Dr. Stephen Novella. He's a clinical neurologist and an assistant professor at the Yale University School of Medicine. In the middle of the broadcast, I'm speaking with a couple of registered dietitian nutritionists. Melissa Dobbins and Leah McGrath are going to join me as we talk about food woo. And then hold on to yourselves, because the Psy Babe, Yvette D'Entremont, is going to join me for the end of the show. She is a force of nature and just all kinds of awesome. I had her on our Debunkers broadcast months ago. We're going to talk to her about quite a few things, but most importantly, I wanted to bring up Vani Hari, the food babe, this quote-unquote nutrition celebrity that has no credentials and yet has become hugely popular. I was at Barnes & Noble the other day, and the food babe had this book that was right there. I mean, it was on a display. It was facing out. It was being highlighted and featured, and you can just figure people are walking by, and they see this polished presentation, and they say, oh, here's a fun way to learn more about nutrition, and they pick up the book. Well, Yvette actually has a background in science. She has a BS in chemistry and a degree in forensic science, and she's been a very public critic of the food babe. So she's going to join me for the last half hour of the show, and I'm just going to let her go. I'm just going to let her do what she does, okay? And it's going to be wildly entertaining. The truth is, of all the things I want this show to accomplish, one of the things is that I want it to help make people's lives better. I want to learn things. I want our audience members to learn things. And, you know, we can step beyond the basics of dealing with religious claims and atheism as a movement or whatever, and we can talk about the things that affect our lives and science and pseudoscience in relation to health and the foods we eat, I think, is a fantastic fit. So I'm glad to be doing the show tonight. The idea for the broadcast actually came about a few months back. We had taken a trip to the grocery store. Now, we don't often go to a place called Whole Foods. I don't know if they're a national chain or not. But Whole Foods is what you would expect from a quote-unquote healthier grocery store. You know, the entire place is sort of decked out. Their brand is very earth tones, you know, tans and greens and that type of thing. It's all about the organics industry. It's all about whole trade. It's about wild-caught food and no or fewer pesticides or safer pesticides on their food, a lot of herbal stuff, the kind of things you would expect to see in a grocery store targeting people who want to be healthier and live healthier lives. But it was interesting as I was walking around. Well, we finished the trip. We get our groceries back and the food's good. You know, it's all good. And in one of the bags was this big bottle of shampoo. The bottle itself is probably 9 inches tall, almost as big as a 1 liter pop bottle, if that gives you a frame of reference. And around the bottle is this label, and there is, in the tiniest of fonts, a wall of text. You almost need a microscope to be able to read it. And so I was fascinated, and I said, what is this, and what's on the freaking label?
And my stepdaughter said, oh, skip it, Seth. It's just Jesus. Well, now I'm really fascinated. I picked up the bottle, and here I brought it into the studio so I could read it. I'm not going to read the whole thing and take me half the show to read this thing to you. But it is Dr. Bronner's 18-in-1 Hemp Eucalyptus Pure Castile Soap. Certified fair trade made with organic oils. And then it goes into some ingredients. Helpfully, below the ingredients, it has a warning. Don't drink soap. Keep out of eyes. If the cap clogs, poke it clear. Don't squeeze bottle and shoot out soap. And it continues. Flush the eyes. It can be an irritant. Okay, right. But it's soap. Right, I get it. But if you look all around the main label of Dr. Bronner's 18-in-1 Hemp Eucalyptus Pure Castile Soap, certified fair trade made with organic oils, you see a book that has been written by the manufacturers. It is insane. I'm just going to start reading at the top of the label, and I'll go for a minute or two. Let me give you a taste of what this is, okay? Absolute cleanliness is godliness. Teach the moral ABC that unites all mankind free, instantly 6 billion strong, and we're all one. Quote, listen, children, eternal Father, eternally one. Unquote. From Jesus, Manual of Discipline based on Hillel's moral ABC, The Army of Principles of One God Faith Unless the Human Race, as found 1948, by Muhammad's Arabs in Israel, Essene Scrolls, English by soapmaker Bronner. This is just the second line of 1, 2, another paragraph, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. There's 9 paragraphs just on the front of the label. Under one eternal Father, I must teach friend and enemy the full truth, moral ABC, to unite all mankind free in one God faith. To get it done, a beast can only listen to its friend. A human being must teach love his enemy, or that being is not yet human. A shark can only love its friend. Lacking frontal lobes, it must avoid fear, smear, hate, slander, dominate, dictate, distort, destroy anything it does not know, understand, and disagrees with. That's a shark. But a human being possessing the kingdom of God's law, the Essene moral ABC of the free within, has frontal lobes, works hard to teach friend and enemy the moral ABC, otherwise that being is not yet human. All right, so that's just the top, let's call it 20% of the front of the label. On the back, there's a side label that separates the two, so you have to turn the bottle sideways. Next to the logo, it says, in all we do, let us be generous, fair, and loving to spaceship Earth and all its inhabitants, for we're all one or none, all one. If you get a chance, Google image search Dr. Bronner's, B-R-O-N-N-E-R apostrophe S, Dr. Bronner's 18-in-1 Hemp Eucalyptus Pure Castile Soap. I said, why did you buy this? What is this? And they're like, oh, it's really good soap. It really is. Sure, it's got crazy shit on the label. But it's good soap. I guess that's all that matters. So, Dr. Bronner, thanks for opening the show for me today. Thanks for your contribution to the monologue. This is one of the stranger things I have seen in a long, long time. This broadcast is about good health and about pseudoscientific claims in regard to good health. You know, my first guest being Dr. Stephen Novella. I've been streaming on the Great Courses Plus, a series by Dr. Novella called Your Deceptive Mind. It's a fascinating exploration into the human brain and perception and critical thinking, logic and logical fallacies, science versus the supernatural, that kind of thing. Really interesting stuff. It's one of thousands of offerings at the Great Courses Plus, which provides content, lectures, education by award-winning professors and streams them right into your life. You can download them to your computer, watch them on your television, your laptop, your tablet, your smartphone, in whatever subject or topic interests you. Psychology, science, history, religion, hobbies, the arts, so much to choose from. The Great Courses Plus is changing. It's enhancing how education happens here in the 21st century, and I think you're going to love them. In fact, the Great Courses Plus is offering a free month to my listeners. You can access the entire library, every course, for free for 30 days. So check them out and let your education continue. Start your free month right now by going to thegreatcoursesplus.com/SethAndrews. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/SethAndrews. My first guest on the podcast is Dr. Stephen Novella. He is a clinical neurologist and assistant professor at the Yale University School of Medicine. He's a proponent of scientific skepticism, and he's a very vocal critic of pseudoscientific health claims and claimants. You can read much of his work at the Neurological blog, and Dr. Stephen Novella is kind enough to join me here. Thank you so much for being on the show. It's great to have you.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You just posted an article responding to or addressing the term pseudoscience. You want to talk about that for just a second?
Yeah. So it seems recently there's been a number of commentaries of articles by people who are not active members of the skeptical community, as far as I can tell, essentially saying that we're doing it wrong, which is fine. I don't mind criticism, constructive criticism, thoughtful criticism. But, you know, if you're outside of a community and you're telling them that they're doing it wrong, at least make a good faith effort to understand what they're actually doing. And you know, this article I was responding to was basically saying we shouldn't use the term pseudoscience because it's judgy and it comes off as being elitist and it doesn't really mean anything because there's not a sharp demarcation line between what's science and what's pseudoscience. So I was responding to that basically in defense of the concept of pseudoscience. And my point was, you know, all of the objections I think were not valid. They were based on one logical fallacy or another. Pseudoscience is an important concept. It exists. It's a thing. It's like I said, it's like denialism. Denialism is also a thing. It's worthy of understanding it as a phenomenon. Again, no one pretends that there's this sharp demarcation line. We write, and philosophers write specifically about the fact that there's the so-called demarcation problem, like there is with every complex definition. What's the difference between a cult and a religion? It's a fuzzy line. That doesn't mean you can't meaningfully talk about cults, that they don't actually exist as a real phenomenon. It just means you have to understand how we define such things. What's the difference between a planet and a dwarf planet? You know, that's my favorite example because it's not a lot of social, you know, baggage attached to it. You make these arbitrary definitions, but you're trying to reflect some real understanding of, you know, how the universe is put together. So, yeah, I think the concept of pseudoscience, perfectly valid to use it as long as you understand it. And it's not a throwaway label, but something that you actually try to understand as a phenomenon.
I can think of probably half a dozen off the top of my head, half a dozen people who think that their doctors, their licensed physicians, are terrified, or at least secretly terrified, of alternative medicine because it takes control away from physicians, from the pharmaceutical industry, from all these people and organizations that they have propped up. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that speaks to a conspiracy mindset. Have you addressed this before? I mean, doctors don't want you to know about this.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a narrative. It's a marketing narrative. And like all marketing narratives that you've heard of, they're successful because they tap into something that resonates, that we can understand, or that's emotionally appealing. So, you know, there is over time this evolution of these ideas, and the ones that really work, that really stick, are, you know, the ones that are still around. And then they even get tweaked further until you have these really well-developed narratives that people hear, and it just grabs onto their attention. So people, for some reason, they have an easy time believing that there's this giant conspiracy of the medical industrial complex to keep people sick and to hide cures from them, and that we're afraid of cures that actually work. And it's, you know, the thing is, like many popular narratives like that, if you think about it to any depth, or if you have any actual insight into, you know, how medicine really works, the thing collapses immediately. It makes absolutely no sense. You know, physicians are people. There are people, like all people, who are, you know, think of themselves as good people. They want to do the right thing. You know, most of us are in medicine because there's lots of aspects about medicine that are enjoyable. But one of those aspects is, you know, you're actually helping people. You know, just imagine how cynical and evil you would have to be to be hiding an effective cure from your own patients, the patients that you've taken an oath, you know, to be on their side, you know, to be their advocate, to take care of their health. And you think it might marginally increase your profits to keep them sick. And so you keep a cure from them. Yeah, sure. There are some psychopaths out there who might be that way, but that's not your typical physician. And to think that, I don't know, just if you really think about that, you have to have an almost like childlike, naive view, cardboard view of the world. But some people have just, you know, they compartmentalize that narrative and they believe it, because the part of the narrative they want to believe is there are cures out there. And, you know, if I'm just hip and are willing to go outside of the box, I'll get these really effective cures that the system is trying to keep from me. But again, just, you know, doesn't really survive even casual scrutiny with a little bit of logic and reason.
It also ignores the reality that physicians have family members, friends, spouses, sure, children, loved ones who are negatively affected by cancer and disease and would be desperate to see them saved.
Absolutely. It's like we're all people. You know, we all going through life with the same sort of vulnerabilities, fears, anxieties, same illnesses and sicknesses, same loved ones. Absolutely. Also, that it just doesn't make, even if you assume that physicians are being greedy, it doesn't make sense. You know what really sells? You know what makes an effective profit as a profession? Is being effective. You know, if you treat patients and they get better, that's good for your practice. That's good for your bottom line. Not being effective and keeping people sick is a losing proposition for any profession. It doesn't even make sense internally within their own premises, which of course are, you know, again, ridiculous when you examine them. So it's just not thinking it through. They're just accepting this sort of, again, this childish narrative at face value without giving it much thought.
I had referenced much of your work as a skeptic, including some courses on the great courses, one of which is Medical Myths, Lies, and Half-Truths. What we think we know may be hurting us. You want to flesh that out quickly?
Well, I don't know how quickly I could do it. It's 12 hours of lectures. But I try to cover in that course the things that most people might think, common misconceptions, but that are not true, or just things that people don't really understand well enough to make healthcare decisions for themselves. So, like, for example, a lot of people aren't aware of the fact that antibiotics only treat bacteria and not viruses. So if you have a viral infection, antibiotics will do nothing for you. In fact, they're harmful because you're just contributing to the formation of resistant bacteria. And, you know, if you have that cold, it's almost certainly viral, and therefore you shouldn't take antibiotics. That's a very useful bit of very basic medical information. A lot of people do know it, but a lot of people don't. And so, you know, the course goes over things like that to try to get people to a point where they're essentially basic level of medical scientific literacy so that they can take care of themselves and their family.
Let me just throw a few more out very quickly. Like, I've heard, you got to drink a gallon of water a day to be healthy.
Yeah, or 8 glasses a day, or there's some arbitrary number or amount of fluid, or that you should really force yourself to drink a lot of fluid. And yeah, so the thing that's interesting is that evolution is really good at optimizing systems. You know, once you have a system, it sort of goes to its optimal state pretty quickly through evolutionary forces. So animals have evolved pretty sophisticated mechanisms for managing their own fluid status, you know, the big one being thirst. When you need water, when you need fluid, you will be thirsty. So the only time there's an exception to just following your thirst is when you're going to be pushing the system to its limits. Like, for example, if you're going to be exercising a lot or in really hot weather or at extreme altitude, or not so extreme, even like to climb Mount Wilson 10,000 feet, you can get dehydrated very quickly. So if you sort of push the system to its limits, you might want to stay ahead of the curve, you know, prehydrate, or just make sure you have access to water, because you'll get dehydrated more quickly than you're used to. But everyday life, you know, not really doing anything particular in no extreme environments, as long as you have reasonable access to fluid, and if you drink when you're thirsty, you'll be fine. You don't need to force fluids. In fact, you can, you know, you could hurt yourself by forcing it too much. You can overwhelm your system that way. People who drink a gallon of water a day or more can actually dilute out their electrolytes, and that's unhealthy. I've admitted people to the hospital because they were pushing fluids too much, and they got electrolyte, you know, imbalances that made them sick.
Sharing a meal with a friend, saw nothing but protein on the plate. A diet, going for the ketosis diet. Can we speak about that quickly? What's the claim? What's the reason for doing it? And does it work?
So to back up a little bit, there are three macronutrients: protein, fat, and sugars, carbohydrates. These are the basic sources of calories. Other than alcohol, you know, things like that, there's pretty much all the calories you get are going to be one of those macronutrients: fats, proteins, and glucose. So within a fairly broad range of balance between the three of those types of nutrients, it doesn't really matter where your calories come from. In terms of your weight balance, what really only matters is how many calories you consume and how many you burn off, sort of the calories in, calories out model. And whether those calories are protein calories or fat calories or carbohydrate calories doesn't matter. But for a long time, there's been this idea that if you just have the magic combination or ratio of macronutrients, that magical things will happen and you'll lose weight, or you can eat more food and you won't absorb it, or the weight will magically come off, or you won't be hungry or whatever. And so there's low-fat diets and low-carbohydrate diets and the zone diet. Is that still a thing? Do people still remember the zone?
I've seen the zone, yeah, some people. I don't know if it's popular, but it's out there.
Yeah, I think it's past its peak. But that was like the quintessential notion. You have to be in that sweet spot zone of proportions of macronutrients. But there isn't a lick of science to back up the basic concept that it really matters. You know, as long as you're within a broad range of reasonable balance with your macronutrients, your body handles it just fine. And there is no optimal balance. It's just avoid extremes. You know, having an extreme low carbohydrate diet isn't good for you. It does put you into ketosis, which isn't a healthy state to be in.
Can we define ketosis for the listener?
So your body, especially your brain, needs glucose. It needs glucose. It has to burn glucose for energy. Basically, it stores the energy as fat and it burns it as glucose. If you don't have enough glucose to keep your brain going, then as an alternate energy source, it can live off proteins. Unfortunately, it can't live directly off of fat. Unlike hibernating animals like bears can live off their fat, but we're not hibernating. We don't have the metabolic pathways to do that. So we need a certain amount of glucose in our diet. If it gets too low, then the body starts to eat your own proteins and make ketones, which are a type of protein that the brain can use as an alternate energy source. And so then you get ketosis, which just means you have a lot of ketones in your blood. And ketones are acidic, so it tends to acidify the blood as well. And if it gets too extreme, like in diabetics who can't get glucose into their cells, they start to get what's called ketoacidosis. And that could put them in a coma. It could be a very serious condition. You're not going to do that if you're just having a low carbohydrate diet and you're not diabetic, but there's no reason to think that there's any benefit to ketosis, that it's good for you, that it's not bad for you, that it's in any way a long-term strategy. And so, but all of the theoretical stuff aside, it's been studied, you know, time and again. There's been multiple clinical trials comparing different diets, and there's one consistent signal in the literature on dieting, and that is the only thing that matters is the number of calories you're eating. It doesn't matter what the proportion of those calories are. That's it. You know, long term, it just doesn't matter. You know, short term, you know, it may be easier to reduce your calories in the short term by just eliminating carbohydrates. So the studies tend to show some short term advantage, but the advantage is really insignificant, in my opinion. You know, you lost an extra pound over those 4 or 6 months. Good for you. I mean, it's medically insignificant. And then they actually lose ground over like a year out. They're actually worse off than people who weren't trying to have the extremely low carbohydrate diet. But I think it all comes out in the wash. If you look at the whole literature, it just doesn't matter. So then people say, well, they're not studying it properly. They're not having a low enough carbohydrate diet or whatever. But that's just special pleading. No one has been able to produce, you know, a study that reproducibly shows that there's any long-term advantage to, you know, any of these macronutrient diets. The best advice is still very simple, which is just, you know, control the amount that you eat, get regular exercise, eat a varied diet, and make sure you have enough fruits and vegetables in your diet. That's basically it. That is it.
Talking here with Dr. Stephen Novella. So I'm off the tennis court for several months, tennis elbow. I am told that there's a physical therapist that someone knows, a friend of a friend of a friend, who could help me with dry needling. Now, I know that you've spoken to acupuncture in the past. Are the two related, and how fast and how far should I run? In the other direction, I'm a little scared.
Yeah, dry needling is acupuncture. You know, it's acupuncture without appealing to qi, you know, or superstitious explanations for how it works.
Now, there are a lot of people, though, who are atheists or supposed skeptics who embrace acupuncture. They say it's brought benefit, be it a placebo benefit or not. There are a lot of people who say, hey, it worked, or I felt better afterwards. So what the hell, right?
Yeah, that's the it worked for me fallacy, which I've, you know, had to write about a number of times because it is so persistent even among skeptics. The thing is, you don't know if it worked or not. You can't, because you're an N of one. It may be compelling to you that you had a symptom, you took a treatment, and you got better. But our minds conspire to create a simple and compelling narrative out of that. And the fact is, you don't know what would have happened if you didn't take the treatment. Your memory is almost immediately altered to make the narrative seem more compelling. So you sort of clean up all of the messy details, like what the delay was between the treatment and feeling better. And over time, you remember those two things as being closer together. You may forget the fact that you tried six things and this was just the one you happened to do when you got better. Of course, getting better is totally subjective. What does that really mean? You could be just interpreting the normal fluctuation in your symptoms in a way that fits the preferred narrative. You just can't know. You simply can't know. People grossly underestimate our ability to deceive ourselves and to alter our memory and our perception and confirmation bias and all that. Skeptics should understand that. They should understand that. But even still, our own experience is so overwhelmingly compelling that it's hard. You have to be really disciplined to say, this is what I experienced, but you know, I could be wrong. It's probably self-deception and I can't rely upon that. You need to do scientific studies. You need to control for the variables. You need to count all the data, control for confirmation bias, for subjectivity, for placebo effects. If you don't do that, you simply cannot know if something worked or not. And when we do that, I mean, there's been several thousand studies looking at acupuncture for pretty much everything you can imagine. And so far, it hasn't been shown convincingly to work for anything, not a single thing. There isn't a single indication for which there is a, you know, reasonable clinical effect that's replicable under, you know, rigorous or high quality studies from acupuncture. And, you know, you have to ask yourself why. You know, that's an interesting pattern. That pattern is consistent with, you know, again, the simplest explanation is that acupuncture doesn't work, you know, and the studies show it doesn't really matter where you stick the needles or even if you stick the needles. It's just the attention from the acupuncturist that has the entire effect. The acupuncture itself seems to add nothing of any clinical value to the outcome. You know, that's just a slightly longer way of saying it doesn't work. And I mean, if you can't prove an effect after 3,000 studies, I doubt that any further study is going to change that. If this wasn't a hugely marketed and culturally embedded belief system, I mean, nobody would be wasting their time on it. It would have been discarded a long time ago, you know, if it were held to the usual standard of science and reason. But it's just, you know, cultural inertia and the power of marketing, you know, in the hands of people who either are self-deceived or just frankly don't care what the evidence shows. You know, they have a tool, they're going to sell it, they're going to use it.
Beyond the marketing slogans of, hey, we're going to stick it to the system, we're going to sort of go around the traditional, normal, science-based way of doing it and discover these other secrets, a lot of stuff seems to be built just on fear. I mean, they're selling fear. I saw an article just the other day, another article that using your cell phone is going to give you brain cancer.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, if you read that by the end of it, you're ready to throw all your electronics in the trash.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's certainly the world out there is scary. And life is a terminal disease, as we like to say. You know, you're going to die of something. And yeah, when you think about that, it's freaking scary.
So if I use a Bluetooth, I mean, should I be worried at all?
No, the thing is, so, you know, my philosophy is, you know, there's a certain level. You can't prove a zero risk for anything, right? So you got to decide that there's a certain minimum level of risk. When something is the risk is so small based upon the evidence that we have that it's less than the risk of me driving to work every day and just eating food and, you know, going about my everyday life. It's just lost in the noise. It's not worth worrying about. I mean, worry about the big risks. You know, like people are smoking and they're afraid of their cell phone. There's like orders of magnitude difference potential risk there. So the story with cell phones is that, first of all, cell phones emit non-ionizing radiation. So it doesn't have the energy to break chemical bonds. And therefore, it doesn't have the energy to cause mutations. And that's where the real risk of like causing cancer or tissue damage comes from. So from a theoretical point of view, it shouldn't be a health risk. But, you know, we could say maybe something's happening. It's heating up the tissue. It's doing something. So scientists have studied to see if there's any correlation between cell phone use and brain cancer, like glioblastoma and meningioma, like the two most common forms of brain cancer, especially those. And there's a couple of things have emerged. One, and I think this in and of itself is extremely compelling, while cell phone use over the last 20 years has skyrocketed from zero, right, to almost everybody over 20 years, the incidence of brain cancer has not increased. In fact, it's actually decreased a little bit. Hard to know if that's real or not, but, you know, conservatively, we could say the incidence of brain cancer has not changed over the last 20 years. If there was any significant risk to cell phones, we would be seeing a spike, right? We would be seeing, at least by now, we would be seeing those brain cancer incidences going up. The fact that we're not, very reassuring. Also, if you just look to see if you can correlate cell phone use to the risk of brain cancer, or look at people who have brain cancer and ask them about their cell phone use, most of the studies show that there's no convincing correlation. There's just no signal there, if you will. A couple of outliers have shown maybe that there's a correlation, but they're outliers, and they tend to come from the same few researchers. Most of the researchers are fine. And again, whether not not just ones funded by the cell phone industry or whatever. These are a lot of independent studies show that there's just no correlation, you know, between cell phone use and cancer. That doesn't rule out a risk. It doesn't mean that 30 years of cell phone risk, you know, use won't increase your risk. Or if you start really, really young, I mean, this, you know, there's could always again say that there's a risk that we haven't detected yet. But again, you can't prove a zero risk, but what you can say is that the collective evidence does limit how big the risk could possibly be. And in my opinion, you know, looking at this research, if there is any risk, there's no proven risk, but if there is any risk that we're missing, it's so small, it's not worth worrying about. It's less than the risk of living your life, so I just wouldn't worry about it.
Dr. Stephen Novella, you've been very generous with your time. One last thing. Television doctors. I know you've appeared on Dr. Oz. His name seems to come up in these discussions when we talk about debunking and alternative medicine and woo-trition. Television physicians, are they just there for show? I mean, how do we respond?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't been impressed with any of the popular TV doctors. I think that they, at some point, they sell their soul in order to be popular, in order to get the ratings. You know, you have to, first of all, you have to produce a lot of content, and that's challenging. You know, there's always the temptation that you will make something that isn't really a news story into a news story. And, you know, when it comes to medicine, you generally do that with fear or false hope. And, you know, certainly Dr. Oz is guilty of doing his share of that. There have been actual studies looking at the Dr. Oz show, but also the show The Doctors, and like systematically going through a number of episodes and looking at their advice that they give and then comparing that advice to the published evidence. And their advice is horrible. I mean, most of the time, it's not supported by any evidence. Or if it is, it's like the most preliminary evidence, really not worth rising to the level where I would, as a physician, I would advise my patients based upon it. Not certainly, I wouldn't do that. They often will overhype small effects, like they'll say there's an effect, but not say how big the effect is. Like, this reduces your risk of cancer, and they don't say by 0.0001%. You know, they don't include the magnitude of the effect. So their advice is simply not evidence based. It's not really accurate. It's not, in my opinion, very useful. It's just for entertainment purposes. And, I have a huge problem with that. Somebody using their reputation and their authority as a physician to essentially get rich by giving bad advice to the public at large. How can you defend that? I think that that's reprehensible.
Dr. Stephen Novella, I will link to your articles on the science-based medicine website. Is there another site, or is that the best one for your stuff?
Science-based medicine is fine. Neurological blog is another site, and theskepticsguide.org. Those are all my online sites.
Fantastic. For your perspective and time, thank you so much, sir.
It's a pleasure. Thanks.
Next up on the podcast roster, I have a couple of RDNs, registered dietitian nutritionists. These are experts in diet and nutrition. In order to be an RDN, you have to have at least a bachelor's. Most, I think, have advanced degrees. You have to have completed 1,200 hours of supervised internship with experience in clinical and community nutrition, as well as food service, and you have to pass a nationally administered board exam, kind of like an attorney would pass the bar. They also have to continue their education via CEs to make sure that they are up on the latest information about nutrition and health. And my two guests tonight are both RDNs. I want to welcome Leah McGrath and Melissa Dobbins. Great to have you both.
Thank you so much, Seth.
I want to get in better shape. I'm not getting any younger. I want to make good health decisions. You probably hear this quite a bit. So I'll start with you, Melissa. When you are, dealing with people, they're like, I want to be healthier. What do I do, right?
Well, that's a great opening line. Unfortunately, for most people that I would see as a patient or a client, they say, my doctor said I need to come to you. What are you going to take away from me of my favorite foods?
People don't proactively say, I want to be in a better place. They're prodded toward you because they might have some health consequences.
I think it depends on the scenario and the venue that you're in. As an outpatient dietitian, which I spent about 8 or 10 years doing, that was what I saw a lot of. When I was a supermarket dietitian, people would come up to me and say, I have questions about label reading or healthy choices, but it's very rare, even at a cocktail party, that people would say, I want to be healthier. Can you help me? I wish that was the case.
I am totally coming back to label reading. Leah, first, I want to speak with you. Your experience has been people come to you. Are they asking the wrong questions? Do they say, look, I want to be a size X waist, or I want to weigh this much? Or are they more interested in the bigger picture of being healthier, or both?
I think a lot like Melissa said, a lot of people, when they first come to you, say things like, what can I eat to lose weight? And really, nothing that you eat is going to automatically make you lose weight. It's more about what you're not going to be eating or what you're going to be doing in conjunction with the foods, like exercise and changing some lifestyle things that you might be doing. So that is one question I do get a lot.
Is it true that if you eat less food, you gain more weight, that your body actually stores what you eat in a different way or stores it more? How's that work?
Well, I think there is a lot of truth to the fact that you could potentially slow down your metabolism and, you hear about going into more of a starvation mode. But there's a lot of things that have to happen in conjunction with that. Are you exercising less? Are you keeping up an exercise regimen? Are you just focusing on what you're eating? So I think most of us now feel like we really need to encourage people to eat an appropriate amount of calories in conjunction with getting enough exercise and getting the right kind of exercise, too, on a regular basis.
Melissa, if I skip breakfast, have I just hosed myself for the rest of the day? Let's talk about the negative consequences, because we hear those warnings all the time. It's the most important meal of the day. Is it true?
Well, that's a very interesting question. Most of the patients that I would see who are overweight were breakfast skippers. But there's some really interesting research going on right now trying to tease out whether or not breakfast actually has anything to do with our weight. And the jury's still out on that. But aside from studies that have shown it's helpful, studies that have shown it's not really showing much of a difference, the prudent recommendation is still to say it's a good idea to eat breakfast. It's an opportunity to get in some nutrient-rich foods, some fiber, some calcium, some protein. And if you are the typical person who skips breakfast, a lot of times you find you're just so ravenous by lunchtime that you can't make good choices because you're too hungry. You're just going to grab and eat whatever.
If I look at the nutrition label, which you brought up a few minutes ago, it's overwhelming. I've got fat, saturated fat. I've got trans fat. I've got carbs. I've got sodium. I've got sugars. I've got protein. It's a list of vitamins. Which vitamins do I need? It's crazy. How do we keep up with all this? And do the labels genuinely help us, or are they rigged in some way? And I'll start with you, Melissa, and have Leah weigh in.
Well, the food label does contain quite a bit of information. Not all of it applies to each person. So I'm a diabetes educator and I work with people with diabetes. I would have them focus more on the total carbohydrate. Yes, we might look at fat or saturated fat or sodium, but first we look at total carbohydrate and I make sure that they're not just zoning in on the sugars because it's really the total carbohydrate that matters. So it really depends on what a person's goals are. So you have all this information on the food label, but depending on what your individual needs are, there's certain things you can hone in on. And I would say for most people across the board, first thing you would want to look at is what the serving size says. Not because that's what you should necessarily be eating, but that's because that's what the numbers correspond to. So if it's a half a cup of cereal, but you eat a cup of cereal, then you have to do the math and adjust the numbers accordingly.
I'm guilty. I'll say, oh, it's only 300 calories for a serving. And you can put the serving in a thimble. And I didn't catch that part. Leah, did you want to weigh in on this?
I would agree with Melissa, and I think that we're going to see with the new type of nutrition facts panel that what they're saying is a lot of the serving sizes will more accurately represent what people eat. I know at our store, our supermarket, we have a muffin that we sell in our bakery, and you've never seen a person look so crestfallen when you explain to them that the serving size is based on a third of the muffin, so it being 200 calories. And then they do the math and they realize that they just ate a 600 calorie muffin.
Who could eat just a third of a muffin?
Exactly.
Right. Delicious,
exactly.
Piping hot muffin.
Exactly.
Now, I would say that that is a really good example of, okay, we need to do a better job here with serving sizes. But for things like cereal or rice or, I don't know, something that, you know, little children or tiny elderly women might eat a small portion of, but a large man might eat a larger portion of. I mean, I think that that's been a barrier for people to kind of understand food labels because, yeah, people come in different shapes and sizes. People need a wide range of different calories. So that's why maybe the portions were a little smaller and you would just do the math. And I think the message that people got was, A, they didn't even look at the serving, or when they did and they were like, oh my God, I'm eating way more than this says. This label is crazy, or I'm overeating and there's something wrong with me.
Our show is called Health Wootrition and the Food Babe. And I'm speaking about the Food Babe with Sci Babe in just a few. So I'm going to keep the Food Babe on the back burner for now, but I would like to talk about food woo and pseudoscience, bad information, misinformation, what we're often warned about. And I want to start with gluten. What the hell is gluten and why are we supposed to stay away from it? Leah, I'll start with you.
Well, first of all, we're not supposed to stay away from it. Let's start
there. Look, all the labels, all the stuff I buy at the store, it says gluten-free. I mean, come on, it's got to mean something.
You would think that if something needs to be labeled as gluten-free, then gluten itself must be bad. But unless you have celiac disease, or there are some other health conditions that might show an improvement of not having gluten in your diet. And they are discovering different sensitivities that some people might be bothered by gluten. But the general population doesn't need to avoid gluten, doesn't need to be gluten-free.
What is gluten?
Gluten is a protein found in wheat, barley, and rye. So it's what gives your bread its structure. That's what gluten is. So there's nothing intrinsically bad about gluten, but for people who have celiac disease, their bodies cannot process it. So it basically, their immune system attacks their own body.
And I think the reason, you know, we're seeing it on labels more and more these days is because it's being diagnosed more. I don't know the statistics on, was it underdiagnosed before? Are we more aware of it? Is it more prevalent? I'm going to leave that to the gluten experts. But back in the day, all you could do was give somebody a list of naturally gluten-free foods. So things like potatoes, rice, whole foods. So there are a ton of foods that are naturally gluten-free. But if you wanted a cookie or you wanted a pancake or you wanted something just to feel normal like everybody else, you really didn't have any products for that. So I do think those products have helped kind of fill the gap there. However, you know, a gluten-free cookie is still a cookie. So it's not necessarily healthier for you. And if you don't need to avoid gluten, trust me, you don't want to do it.
Talking here with two registered dietitians, Leah McGrath and Melissa Joy Dobbins. Will aspartame give me cancer?
you're just throwing it out there, Seth.
I have a list of questions, and I want to know if all the things that I'm being frightened, I mean, this is going to give you cancer.
Sure.
This will give you cancer. Whatever you do, don't use this. And of course, aspartame is among those warnings, and I wanted to see if somebody could weigh in. Can someone weigh in on aspartame for me?
Sure. So, you know, one of the things that we see a lot of times, I'm sure Melissa feels the same way, is there's so much fear mongering going on around certain products and ingredients. And one of the common techniques of somebody who does fear mongering is they take a product or an ingredient or a food and they attach it to cancer. So whatever it is, it's going to cause cancer. And people are rightfully scared about cancer. There's nothing that is friendly or appealing about the prospect of dealing with cancer. But the reality of the situation is that aspartame is recognized as a safe, non-caloric sweetener, and that any kind of study that you've seen or that you hear about in with many of these items that always going to cause cancer, if you look deeply, it's typically in laboratory animals, and the amounts that they're given are extraordinary amounts, and the amounts that we as humans would have to consume to replicate that a mouse or a rat is given are so extreme that we as humans would never be able to physically consume that amount. So a lot of that is just blown out of proportion. Now, that being said, you know, we want to always encourage people to eat a varied diet and to, you know, include plenty of fruits and vegetables and, you know, not include a lot of products that, you know, are not really good nutritive sources. So nothing wrong with aspartame. There's no risk that you're going to get cancer from having a diet soda with aspartame. That's not going to happen. It's one of those things that people who fearmonger love to throw out there.
As someone who loves sweet things, I am often having the discussion, you know, sweeten low or sugar, Splenda, which I love. I love Splenda. All these warnings about Splenda or sugar. And I honestly don't know what the right decision is.
I'll jump in here as a diabetes educator. I agree with everything that Leah said about aspartame. And I guess I kind of feel like the whole aspartame internet fear mongering thing is sort of died out, but maybe it's still alive and well. I don't know. But to Leah's point, there's a lot of food ingredient fear mongering, and maybe it's because these ingredients have chemical sounding names, but who knows? There's a lot of fear mongers out there who have their own agenda. But when it comes to, and again, I'm a certified diabetes educator, so I want to help empower people to live fuller lives, live healthy lives, and make the best choices they can. Like Leah said, I want them to choose nutrient-rich foods most of the time, but I want them to enjoy their food also. I promote sound science, smart nutrition, and good food. And the good food aspect is you should enjoy and savor your food. And if that means you want a little bit of sugar here or there, or you'd like to save those calories or manage your blood sugar with an artificial or non-nutritive sweetener like Splenda, aspartame, saccharin, whatever, stevia, whatever your choice is, then that's a great way for you to accomplish whatever goals you have, with whether it's weight control, diabetes, or just managing that sweet tooth.
As registered dietitians, I know you have strong opinions about some of the food woo that you hear out there. I'm sure things are brought to your feet and they say, check this out, and you shake your head. So you tell me, what are you hearing out there? Some of the more wrong-headed or odd or bizarre or entertaining pieces of food woo that you've come across, either one of you.
I guess the latest thing I've heard, Seth, is that there's always one diet, and I don't know if Melissa's heard about this one yet. There's always a new diet. When one sort of starts to wane, another one pops up. And lately I've heard about the ketogenic diet, which seems like a cross between, it's like if Atkins and Paleo had a baby, it would be keto, the ketogenic diet. So there's always a new diet that I'll get asked about. And I think this will be the next one that people will be on people's radar. And unfortunately, when people have it on their radar and they start talking about it, then we'll start to see brands bringing out products in the hopes that people will buy them. And this ketogenic diet is a high protein, high fat diet to really actually, I guess, make you run on ketones. I don't know a whole lot about it, but I'm starting to see a lot of buzz about it online. And I read an article recently in one of the trade magazines for the retail industry that we're going to start to see products that are being marketed to people following a ketogenic diet. And I'm sure, Melissa, you remember, like when we were in internships and in clinical rotations, the time that you'd use a ketogenic diet was on somebody with epilepsy and seizures. We would never have thought about using that on a healthy individual, right?
Right. There are certain clinical patients who require a ketogenic diet, and there's research and science to support that. But I haven't heard about this new trend, although I have to say it sounds somewhat like paleo, although I know that paleo, there's like a whole paleo spectrum. But certainly it's higher in protein, lower in carb, and I think the fat content can vary. So it sounds similar to that.
When I was in radio in the 90s, I remember we had an advertiser. It was some herbal thing. You know, herbal remedies continue their popularity in some form or another. Yeah. These little capsules, I'm sure it was just lawn clippings. Who knows what was in the capsules? But it was, you know, take these with an 8-ounce glass of water once every day. And on top of that, eat sensibly, exercise, and drink a gallon of water. And and we were like, wow, this herbal diet is amazing. You know, I've lost 10 pounds in 2 weeks.
Sure.
And of course, the obvious hadn't quite hit us. Melissa, what's on your food woo radar these days?
Well, I just have to say, your little comment there, I mean, that's basically why I became a dietitian, because I was tired of seeing products and scams like that out there.
Somebody's making some serious coin.
Yes, they are. And taking not just the money, but just taking advantage of people's desperation. And it just made me sick. And I was good at science, and I thought I was going to go into chemistry and pharmacy. And I decided I wanted to work with people. And that's when I found out about nutrition and dietetics. And so it really kind of came full circle for me, because I could help people. You know, as far as the food woo, here's the thing that I think most people don't understand. It's not whether, you know, natural, organic, processed, fat-free, gluten-free, sugar-free. Here's where I think the problem is. People do not know what a registered dietitian is. They don't know. Yesterday, my mother-in-law came to visit, and she's 77, and she does ballroom dancing. She has a personal trainer. She's amazing. And she's had some nutritional issues, and she asked me to help her, but it was whatever her issue was not my specialty. So I connected her with a local dietitian who specializes in what she needs. And I said, have you reached out to this dietitian yet? And she said, no, but my personal trainer is so helpful. He's so knowledgeable in nutrition. And I said, are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? You're driving a stake in my heart. This is blasphemy. But this is like in my own family. People do not know that your personal trainer, your chiropractor, typically, and I'm generalizing, are not a credible source of nutrition. Some personal trainers are also registered dietitians. Some chiropractors have gone to school for nutrition training, but I'm here to tell you that all nutritionists are not registered dietitians. but all registered dietitians are nutritionists. And I think that most people don't know that, but most importantly, they don't know what a dietitian can do for them. Dietitians are not the food police. We are more like coaches than referees. We are here to help people make decisions and set realistic goals that empower and make a difference in their lives.
So we are really in urban legend territory everywhere you look, everywhere you turn. I mean, I saw someone just the other day. He's an intelligent man. He's got an engineering degree. He is hugely intelligent. He won't microwave his food because he's afraid he's damaging or perhaps even causing the food to become radioactive or something. He won't heat his food in the microwave. And I thought, you probably deal with this kind of thing a lot.
Well, I think the important thing is that you need to start off with listening to people to see where this is coming from. And there's some people, Seth, that no matter what you say or what links you provide them with, what resources, what science, what, you know, what credible source, they're still not going to believe you. And so there's really nothing that you can do. And then there's people who are just genuinely curious or concerned. And those are the people that you may be able to help and inform. And whether it's people, because they usually come to you with a question, they don't come to you with a position. And that may be the hopeful place that you can help them understand.
I love the internet. I mean, I'm not griping about the internet. I do. I love the internet. It has opened up the world. It makes this show possible. It has connected me with people and information I would have never had access to before. But you're well aware of the dark side. There's a website supporting and promoting and warning about and against pretty much everything. How hard has the internet made your job? I'll start with you, Melissa.
Actually, the internet is an opportunity, and it's an opportunity for dietitians to have a stronger voice and reach more people. My background is in traditional media. I've done more than 200 live TV interviews, traditional radio, but as times change, those opportunities kind of shrank. And so I branched out into social media. And I think we need more credible voices out there to drown out the fear mongers, first of all, because it's one thing to put out kind of bogus information. It's another thing to fear monger. And again, like take advantage of people who are desperate and they'll spend their money and just follow you blindly. I think that's extreme, but it's an opportunity. You know, there's going to be all kinds of different information and resources out there, but it's our job as health professionals to make sure that when people go searching for information, they can find credible resources.
Leah McGrath, anything on that?
I think that there are some big pros and cons to the internet. I think that on the one hand, it does give you an opportunity. On the other hand, it gives everybody else an opportunity too. It's like the Wild West. It's open for business all the time, 24 hours a day.
And you then, in many cases, become the debunkers. Well, actually, there's no science to prove that. Oh, no, that's actually not supported by the evidence. That's partially true, but let me clarify. You probably have to do a lot of education.
Well, you kind of have to pick your battles, too. Like, back to my point, you know, those are people who, no matter what you say, they're going to say, well, what do you know? You're bought out by big ag, big pharma, big food. You're just a shill. What do you know? Because they already have their position. They already have their point of view. And then there are other people who may say, oh, well, let me look at and see what she's saying or he's saying and look at those resources. And, you know, maybe they're quietly watching and listening and absorbing and are not interacting with you, but they're just watching and listening quietly.
Well, one of the goals of this show was to provide some tools so that people can make healthier decisions. You know, I really want this show to better people's lives, not just be entertaining and not just have some data points, but I really want it to ripple outward so that they can have better lives and have better information. Can either or both of you give me some sourced, credible landing zones for our listeners to go if they have questions related to diet, food, good health, that kind of thing? Melissa Dobbins?
Absolutely. eatright.org is the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics website. You can find a dietitian right on the homepage. There's a link that says find a dietitian. Not only can you find a dietitian, but you can find one near where you live and one that specializes in whatever you're focused on, whether it's gluten-free or diabetes or child nutrition, whatever. I have a podcast called Sound Bites, and on that podcast, I interview different health professionals, a lot of dietitians, researchers, authors, and delve into some of these topics that we're hearing in the media or the things that I think are really important versus what we might be hearing in the media.
This is legitimate dietary science-based information. It is.
Absolutely.
We're not talking about food chakras or anything.
You know, no. No.
I don't know what a food chakra is, Seth.
I just made that up.
But you lived in Nashville, so you probably know.
I just conjured that out of thin air. Leah McGrath, do you have any specific recommendations for us?
Yeah, you know, I think the U.S. government actually does a great job. And I would agree with Melissa to start out with.
Oh, no. You just ensured that you're going to see the hair on the back of the neck all over the listening audience. You actually say the government's resource is good.
Well, you know what? Because they don't have any kind of financial interest in trying to sell you anything. I think that's a good place to start. So I would, first of all, agree with Melissa, eatright.org for the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics. But if you're looking for general information about how to plan meals and how many calories to eat, the USDA, the FDA, myplate.gov, these are all sites that use science-based information. They're not trying to sell you supplements. They're not trying to sell you their cleanses or detoxes. They're just there to give you the most reliable information they can. So we have great resources with the FDA, the USDA, the CDC, and those are places that people can go easily to get some very credible and science-based, evidence-based information.
Yeah, I was just giving you a hard time. I mean, you know, the FDA is not trying to sell me the FDA book of how to lose 20 pounds in 10 days kind of thing. I totally understand that. For your time and your expertise, I do appreciate it. Any final thoughts? Anything we missed? Leah McGrath, Melissa Dobbins, before we sign off?
I would just encourage people to be critical thinkers, and when you hear something that sounds unbelievable, question it and go to some place where you can fact check what somebody's saying.
I would add that sometimes what sounds scary is actually not, and vice versa. Something that seems like it really makes sense, there might be more truth behind what you're seeing, especially with agriculture, which we touched on briefly. But most of all, I would just encourage people to remember that when you hear information and news in the media about different research studies, one research study does not change the whole body of research. And it can seem like that, you know, one day coffee is good for you, the next day is bad. Try not to be swayed by that. Take a step back. And if you don't know what the body of research says, talk to your doctor, obviously talk to a registered dietitian. But most of all, keep in mind that you are unique. So what works for one person may not work for you. And that doesn't mean that what they're doing is wrong or right. You have to find your own way and your own healthy lifestyle. It's not about a sample menu or a diet prescription. It's about healthy habits that fit into your lifestyle.
Is that a listen to your body kind of recommendation?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's part of the challenge with nutrition is that, you know, you might not be a registered dietitian, but everybody eats. So everybody's an expert in food because they know what their food preferences are. They know when they eat certain things, they don't feel so good. They feel great when they eat other things. And so that has to be part of the whole kind of package.
Melissa Joy Dobbins and Leah McGrath, thank you so much for your time and for your expertise and for educating our audience. It's been a real pleasure.
Thanks so much, Seth.
Coming up in my final segment on the broadcast, I'm going to talk to Yvette D'Entremont, otherwise known as Psybabe, who's done plenty of writing and blogging and posting about a specific nutrition celebrity out there on the pop culture landscape. Vani Hari is known as the Food Babe. Vani has no real background or expertise in diet or nutrition, and yet she's become hugely popular. And the Psybabe, who does have a background in science, has been weighing in. And she's going to weigh in again in just a second. So hang on. My final guest on our broadcast is known as Sci Babe. Her name is Yvette D'Entremont. She's a public speaker. She's a science blogger. She has a whole blog that's pretty much dedicated to, quote, clearing up misinformation about science, food, and nutrition. She often goes after alternative medicine, the anti-vaxxers, and many, many others, including the Food Babe. I wanted to get this story firsthand, so I invited Yvette back to be on the broadcast. And it's great to have you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me on again. I missed you so much.
You have, of course, rocketed into the stratosphere. Yeah. You are now famous, quote-unquote famous.
It's so weird. I'm fame-ish.
Remember the little people, Yvette? You know?
Last time I was on here, I had, like, I had 150,000 fewer followers. So it's been a little while.
It's been awesome, though. I mean, you know, you add some personality to some pretty hard discussions about some often unpopular things. I mean, we live in a culture where people are, they speak in these sort of weird bumper stickers. I've been guilty in the past,
Yeah.
Artificial bad, natural good is normally where I would start.
Oh, yeah. I was anti-GMO at one point in time. I have been against so many of the things that I speak in favor of now. And it's obviously because Monsanto, implanted the chip and, you know, zombified my brain. And now I've been paid off sufficiently so that I'm in favor of all of them. Obviously, wait for somebody to take that clip and use it out of context.
You've already guaranteed that my comment sections and that my email inbox are going to be filled with hate and death.
Oh,
so
yes.
Let's just camp out here for just a second before we get to the Food Babe. Okay.
Look at it. We can do this.
So are you letting Monsanto off the hook? I mean, come on. I'm not one of those people who believes that, you know, all pharmaceutical companies are evil. I don't buy into that. But I also know that wherever there is money, there is going to be corruption, right? Wherever there is business, there's going to be corruption. So I look at Monsanto and I say, well, you know, are they really squeaky clean?
I would say, much cleaner than the pharmaceutical industry. Is my general approximation on them. And I mean, I'm probably going to be taking a tour of Monsanto in a couple months. And this is something that people, I think, don't realize how regulated their industry is. Because I used to work as a pesticide research chemist, researching this stuff for safety and for efficacy. And people don't realize what a regulated environment it is at this point in time. And it's like I have friends who work there now. Whenever I have a question on a new thing that's coming out saying Monsanto is doing this evil thing, I automatically call someone up on the hotline and say, what's happening with this? What's the real story behind this? And I mean, I've yet to hear one of the crazier stories about Monsanto pan out, because think about it this way. Does anybody, like, and I think this is what happens with the internet culture of the sky is falling. I think people actually think what's happening behind the scenes at Monsanto is this pinky in the brain-esque, you know, what shall we try to do tonight, Brian? The same thing we do every night, pinky, only with Monsanto executives trying to subvert the world's food supply. And, like, that's not what's happening. They're actual human beings trying to figure out what tools that farmers need to combat certain things that are harmful to crops and to the food supply. And whenever a new technology comes out into the market, it's always looked at with suspicion. Now, the new technologies are coming out because there is a need for them on the market. People don't see that there was once upon a time, you know, an issue with, you know, for the farmers needing to combat, you know, certain, never mind just weeds, but certain types of fungus, certain types of diseases that were bad for crops. And this is why we have genetic modification. This is why we have certain types of pesticides and fungicides. And they're heavily regulated and researched before they get to market. So Monsanto has, and now let's get into the really long history of Monsanto, because the corporation's been around for a long time. Monsanto, once upon a time, was a very different company. So this is where we get into the whole Agent Orange PCB thing. Once upon a time, they were much more of a chemical company, and they had some contracts with the U.S. government and with the military to make some very bad things that did some horrible, horrible things. This is where I admit Monsanto did bad shit. Let's just say it. They did horrible
things. What kind of bad things? I mean, just give me a broad stroke here.
Agent Orange did some horrible things. It had something in it called a dioxin.
I'm sorry. They actually manufactured Agent Orange? I thought it was a figure of speech.
That's not a lie. So
you don't have to explain Agent Orange to me. Yes, I get that.
We have seen the pictures. Now, whenever you see a meme saying they're still manufacturing a pesticide that has a component of Agent Orange, here's the miscommunication or the way it's being misleading. There are multiple components in Agent Orange. There's the dioxin that was horribly damaging to humans and to the environment. And there was another component, a pesticide in there that's very non-lethal. It's very not damaging and very useful in pest management today. I believe it's 2,4-D. It's been a little while since I've been in a pesticide lab, but that one is very easy to work with and is still useful in pest management today. So whenever you see somebody saying, and I believe that one is now being used in Enlist Duo. It's the thing that Dr. Oz got all up in arms about last year. And that one's still being used perfectly harmlessly. And it's, you know, it doesn't have the dioxin in it. So it's nutty to me that people will hear something, it was a part of Agent Orange, and they'll scream, you know, Monsanto's poisoning you, because they don't take the time to look at the components of this or to look at what Monsanto's like today. So here's what we have for Monsanto now. It's a company that has drastically changed. It's not owned by the same group of people and is now focused on making tools for farmers and very much less focused on government contracts for the U.S. military. So now, I mean, if you ever get a tour of Monsanto, which I suggest going and checking out, you'll have a look at what they're doing for agriculture research. There's somebody who was doing research on why the bees were, why the bee population was lowering. And he said, you know what, Monsanto has the best tools for fighting this problem. I'm going to go work for Monsanto. My friend Vance Crowe, now at one point I was anti-Monsanto, and this is, I have a long history of kind of looking into this type of stuff. When Vance started working there, his job title was Director of Millennial Engagement. And that sounds like such a super evil job title. It's like, I'm going to get the millennials on our side. And he laughs about his job title all the time. And I thought, I'm like, wow, they even got somebody to get the millennials. Like, and he said when he got the job, he's like, you know what, if there's anything weird going on here, I will find out all about it. And I'll be able to spread the information to people. And if there's nothing weird, I'll be able to tell people about it. And he's been working there for a while. And he's like, no, everything seems on the level. So he's interviewed part of his job is interviewing and getting to know all of the scientists and all the science that happens behind the scenes there so that he can communicate about it. He's a calm guy. And he and I have a lot of talks about how to communicate the science that they do there better. And it's been wonderful to see how they're kind of catching up on how to tell people here's the science that happens at Monsanto.
You're just a shill. They're going to bring you in. They're going to wine you and dine you.
They have yet to pay me a thing.
They're going to slip you a check, put you on the marquee.
If one day they give me money, I will tell people. I promise. But for now, zoom in on my empty wallet. No shill bucks from Monsanto. It's in full disclosure. I've spoken at conferences that were sponsored by, I believe, Dow and Bayer at this point, but I promise you, like, I'm not driving a BMW and living in a McMansion yet, sponsored by Monsanto. So this is not there's not been Monsanto shill bucks in my bank account yet. But if it ever happens, I'll be the first to admit it. I promise.
All right, your strength is chemistry, right? Yeah. Or at least one of your strengths.
Yeah, my academic backgrounds are, let's see, bachelor's in chemistry, master's in forensics with a concentration in toxicology, and I worked for years as an analyst. Local chemist, correct.
Walk us through pesticides and pesticide-free, because this is another thing that we tend to speak about in broad strokes. Oh my God, they use pesticides and we're ingesting this into our bodies. It's terrible.
We're all going to die immediately and it's going to be horrible. And look at my third arm that came out from eating conventional. And wait, that hasn't happened to anybody yet. So here's the deal. And a lot of people see organic and they think pesticide-free, right? Notice that there's no sign on organic that says pesticide free. Have you wondered why that's the case?
I have actually not thought about it. I just saw organic and thought, oh, organic good.
Organic good. And that's what a lot of people do. And that's very tricky marketing with the whole, they're kind of greenwashing it. Organic does not mean pesticide free. It means it was made with a different set of farming standards, which includes certain pesticides. And some of those pesticides are more toxic than the synthetic pesticides. It basically means that you can't use most synthetic pesticides. They have to be derived from natural sources. And some of them, like rotenone, are much more toxic than they have a lower LD50 than the synthetic pesticides. So, and they have to be applied more often because they're not as targeted towards the species they're trying to kill. The synthetic ones in general, it means they said, all right, let's find something that we can apply less often, that is targeted more towards the species that we're trying to kill, that's less toxic to humans, more toxic to the fungus that we're trying to attack. And genetic modification, kind of a separate subject, but genetic modification of some of the plants has allowed farmers to apply fewer and a smaller quantity of pesticides on the plants. I know that farmers in India have said that their BT brinjal, the BT eggplant, has allowed them to apply very small to almost no pesticides. So I know that GMOs and pesticides are kind of separate, kind of intertwined issues, but genetic modification has been a huge boon in the ability of farmers to cut down on how much it costs them to manage their pests and in their ability to grow crops that are pest free. So it's been wonderful to see how biotechnology has been helping farmers and help cut down on costs for the consumer eventually.
Yvette, would you introduce our audience to the food babe very quickly?
Gladly.
I know this is a subject near and dear to your heart. That's why you're the first person I thought of when I thought, I got to have a guest.
So Bonnie Hari has very nice hair and a very poor grasp of science when it comes to food. And here's the thing. I'm not saying anything about her personally. I don't know Bonnie Hari. I've never met her and sat down with her to coffee. As far as I know, after she drinks her organic latte, maybe she's a very pleasant person. That's a possibility. I don't know her. But what I do know about her is that she's wrong about a lot of things. So, I mean, it bothers me when I post something about her and people call her nasty names because we don't know her. We don't know a thing about her. As far as I know, we might get along if it wasn't for these things we disagreed with. But she says things that are patently wrong. She said things like when you microwave water. And I mean, we had to freeze page this because she tried to delete all the record of this existing off the internet. She thinks that if you microwave water, it makes the crystals look like crystals that occur when you yell Hitler or Satan at the water, because water has a memory, or water has ears and apparently an understanding of 20th century European dictators. That's what I got out of that. She also thinks that air in airplanes has a different composition than air elsewhere, and then pilots control the flow of oxygen onto airplanes. And be warned, airplane air has nitrogen in it. It's not 100% oxygen, unlike air elsewhere, according to Saint Bonnie.
Wow.
It has some nitrogen, up to 50% nitrogen. And apparently nobody told her, unlike in seventh grade science class, that air everywhere is about 78% nitrogen. And it was this wonderful article on her saying that airplanes thrive in different conditions than we do. And it was the most amazing article I read. And it got just destroyed on this Facebook page called Shit Pilots Say. And it was a glorious 2 days of people making fun of her for that. But I mean, beyond that, the things she says about food are patently wrong.
Now, she doesn't have an education. Her background is in computer science, right? Not nutrition.
Exactly. Now, here's the thing. The other thing about her is that she had a background in debate. She, I believe, was through high school and early college a nationally ranked debater. So she's very good at showing her one side of an argument and disregarding all the facts that don't agree with her. So that's something that Bonnie is wonderfully talented at, and I can't take that away from her. And I would love it if one day she had a change of heart, saw the science as being accurate, and mobilized her base to do good work on this side, because man, wouldn't that be amazing? She has a million followers or over a million followers. Like, it's kind of like what happened. Like, after, you know, I wrote a little bit of an article last year that made a bit of a splash and made some people realize that maybe she wasn't on the level. It was called "The Food Babe Blogger is Full of Shit Because I'm One to Mince Words." And here's the sad thing. Now, I got a lot of emails saying, you know what? I followed her casually for her recipes, and then I realized that some of the stuff she wrote was crazy and atrocious. Thank you for opening my eyes to this. I'm no longer following her. I'm going to check out science and evidence-based stuff. I'm like, wow, that was great. And she lost some followers, and the rate at which she was getting new followers slowed down for a while. But much like when James Randi debunked Uri Geller and some of the other, you know, quote-unquote psychics, she still has a career. What I did was I bumped her out of mainstream media. Like, there was talk of her getting a television show. That's gone. Like, she was someone who regularly appeared on CNN and in mainstream media for her opinions on food and nutrition and saying, these have toxins in it, you should do a cleanse. Like, that's not happening anymore. So that's the really good part of the end result that happens. But she's still making money hand over fist within the tiny little natural food movement that still loves its own. But like, the reason that she was a target of my strong opinions on these things,
yeah, your ire, yeah,
yes, is that she was getting into the mainstream and spreading really, and her information was being accepted as accurate by mainstream resources, and it wasn't being questioned. And whenever it was questioned, and this is part of how mainstream journalism works, and it's not the fault of the journalists at all. It's like I talked back and forth with Courtney Rubin at the New York Times, who wrote, you know, tried to take a swing at her, took a legitimate swing at her with some really good writing, but they have to do that false balance. They have to say, you know, some scientists disagree with her. Here are the other scientists who don't. And, you know, they have to show opinions from like the type of experts, quote unquote experts, who do agree with her. So they reach out to people like David Gorski and to Stephen Novella and to the other experts that we know are very skeptical and have the science-based evidence that show that she's wrong. And then they quote the people that are in her little bubble that say that detoxes are a thing. When I finally, you know, got a chance to write my article about her, I was under no obligation to say that there was a balance here. I was under no obligation to give the 2%, not even the 2% of doctors that say, yeah, Vonnie's right. I'm like, no, I'm giving you the 99.99% of the medical establishment's opinion that she's full of shit.
On her Wikipedia page, it says that Time Magazine in March of last year, had named her one of the 30 most influential people on the internet.
Now, this is one of those fun little things that I love. Number one, influential does not mean smart or accurate. And number two, that was based on online voting that she heavily promoted on her Facebook page for people to vote for her. So it was one of those things. I think they started with like 100 some odd people, and they were random internet personalities, and she just kept promoting it nonstop on her page for people to vote for her.
This was like vote for me for student council kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, it's how you always end up with the doofus kid who says, I'll make it pizza every day and physics is optional. Like, that's how it's, except for her, it's going to be organic kale every day. Gluten-free kale for president. That's Bonnie. But here's the thing. She might be popular, but she's wrong. And some of the information she's giving out at this point is dangerous, because recently she announced that she was pregnant. If she's tuning into this, Bonnie, congratulations on your pregnancy. I hope you vaccinate. When she announced that she was pregnant, started saying things like, she's going to be the worst mother ever. I'm like, I don't know her. I'm sure she's going to love her kid, because, you know, who doesn't love her kid? They have a lot of money. The kid's going to be well taken care of. But she's going to screw the kid up in terms of the child's attitude on food and having this weird complex that half the foods on the planet are dangerous, which is crazy. But the one thing that I kind of said was, I hope she vaccinates. A few weeks later, she came out saying, like, this wishy-washy statement saying, people have been asking me about the vaccine issue. I've looked into it and quote unquote done my research. And I hate whenever I hear someone saying I've done my research, unless they're sitting in a research lab with a bunch of test tubes. And she endorsed, or not endorsed, but she said, here's a book I recommend on vaccines. And of course it was from an anti-vax doctor. I'm like, oh, Vanny.
Now, do you think she has a legal, not just a moral, do you think a parent should be forced by rule of law to vaccinate a child?
I think that if you're going to go to public schools, you need to get vaccinated. Like, because there are going to be other children in that public school who have disorders that don't allow them to vaccinate, and that eventually lead them very susceptible to these. So yeah, I get it. Parents want autonomy. I understand that. You want to make medical decisions for your own children. However, health is a public good on some level. And when you say, I want to be able to make this decision on my own, you're not just making it for your own child. You are contributing to what could be a public health crisis and kind of violating what I call the non-aggression, or what, you know, the non-aggression principle when it comes to public health, because I get it. I kind of use the your right to swing your fist ends at my face, but I transfer that over to germs. Your right to swing your germy bullshit ends at my immune system. So,
you know, even if we were to stop at the right to the child, don't you think that has merit? I mean, it's not just the herd immunity thing. It's the kid has the right to be able to be vaccinated against whatever. Yeah.
The sad thing is the child has no rights in this. And this is one of the, at some point I want to write up a blog entry on this, and I know I'll get a lot of hate for it because I'm at the point where I get hate mail for everything. And I kind of look at it and go, oh, I'm wounded. Tear.
Well, some people thrive. Some people are empowered.
I just look at them and go, your rage fuels me. Yeah. It's not a day ending in Y if I'm not making somebody angry on the internet. I'm like, if you don't want to vaccinate, you have to check out from society. Like, that's just how it is, because these are, like, I find the people that are choosing not to vaccinate, they're not choosing just to not vaccinate themselves. They're not hurting themselves. They are hurting a vulnerable child.
Let's come back to the food babe real fast and GMOs. As I understand it, she was at the 2012 Democratic National Convention holding up a sign.
Oh, yeah. And that
said, label GMOs.
And here's a funny story behind that. She claims that that was a random moment out of passion, and that she used a lipstick of hers to make that picture on the back of a flyer that they gave them. It was black. Like, the drawing on that, the label GMOs sign, was black. She doesn't look like a girl who wears black lipstick. I'm just saying, I've scribbled lipstick on something before. It's messy.
Well, come on. And GMOs, they're genetically modified. How screwed up is our food? And if we ingest it, you know, that kind of
thing. Okay, fine. I'm going to admit it all right now. Monsanto buzzed into my brain their mind control chip. And that's the only reason why I'm saying that GMOs aren't going to kill you. Anyway, so the real truth is that we're kind of all scared of GMOs because of this wonderful quote from Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. We all love Hitchhiker's Guide, right? This is why it is. This great quote from Douglas Adams. Anything, and I'm going to screw up the quote, but follow me. Any technology that's there when we're born, we're taken as wonderful and perfect. Anything that comes up, like, until the age of 35 is a wonderful new technology to be embraced. And anything that shows up after about the age of 35 is to be suspicious of and fucking burned. And that's what GMOs are to us, is they're new and we're suspicious and we don't understand them, and burn the witch. And the witch is Monsanto in this case. And I think whenever we see GMOs, like, we don't ask why we started using them. The question that we ask is, what's suspicious here? And it's because they're new and we don't understand them. So my question, whenever I see a new technology, or I have a few questions, is, what did we have before this? And why wasn't it good enough? Why did this come out of this? So we, before GMOs, before pesticides, we had famines and we had much higher food prices, and we had farmers who really struggled to make crops work. The other thing that was happening, and this happened with several crops that we just don't remember, because what person our age remembers exactly what the food looked like 50 years ago? We don't remember the crops that went extinct because certain funguses, certain viruses made them go away forever. We had a different type of banana 70 some odd years ago called the Gros Michel. And it went out because I believe it was a, it's either a virus or a fungus. I'm having a blank moment on this one, but it was the reason that we have the Cavendish banana now, the ones that are a little bit longer, a little bit thinner. The Gros Michel was a little shorter and fatter. The Cavendish withstood it so much better. So that was what they started mass planting. Now the Cavendish banana is starting to become susceptible to this attack from this, I believe it's a fungus. So one of the only ways that they can possibly fight this is with genetic modification. And that's kind of what they did to save Hawaiian papaya, was they gave it, and this is brilliant, they gave it kind of a vaccination via genetic modification. And it was funny, if you look back through old videos of Bill Nye, you can see Bill Nye arguing against GMOs, and he's holding up a picture of the non-genetic or genetically modified papaya and the genetically modified papaya, and saying, look, this one has spots on it and it's perfectly fine to eat. And this one doesn't have spots on it and it's genetically modified. There's no problem with the non-GMO one. It just has some spots. But what Bill Nye left out was that the plant that the papaya was on would die. And eventually it was going to go extinct if we didn't genetically modify it. So he was leaving out that the farmers were hurting and that the entire industry was going to go away if we didn't genetically modify it. So genetic modification can save industries and entire bits of bioculture that we have. So it's something that I think people don't see when they hear genetic modification. All they hear is Frankenfood. And this is literally changing one, maybe two, I mean, handful of genes maximum in a very targeted way. The next thing that they go to is, well, it's not natural. Well, you know what? It's changing, like I said, one gene. What's natural about hybridization? You're selecting very carefully one or two bits of plant that you have desirable traits from, and thousands of genes are without control, are randomly changing when you throw them into a field and hope for the best. Conversely, when you do it in a lab, you're testing them down to the very last gene for possible effects on the environment, for possible effects on human beings. And they take about over a decade sometimes to get to market. And there are extremely stringent regulations in place before they get to your dinner table. So there are a lot of objections that I've heard, and none of them really pan out when you look at the facts of the matter. So they're better for farmers. They're better. There are a lot of different reasons why we genetically modify things, but when it comes down to it, none of them pan out with science.
How would you sort of bullshit proof somebody who was trying to navigate these decisions? I want to be healthy. I want to ingest healthy things. I want to live a healthy life. Woo free. What would you recommend?
Make sure you're keeping track of your calories and make sure you're getting your fruits and vegetables in there. Your whole grains are important. Make sure you're getting a good amount of fiber, and once in a while have a fucking cupcake. Like live a little. Food is not a zero sum game of just the nutrition. We're lucky enough to live at a time in history where we have a time of plenty. Enjoy the food. God damn it. It's delicious. But, enjoy the food without letting it kill you, please, because we're also unfortunate enough that we live in a time when we can eat ourselves to death. So be smart with yourselves. The back of the label is more important than the front of the label. So don't, ignore unless you have celiac disease. It looks like gluten-free does not affect you. Unless you're a vegan, the vegan label does not make it healthier. I mean, it doesn't really make it healthier anyway, but unless you're vegan, that doesn't mean much for you. Ignore all the stuff saying organic, because fair trade does not even guarantee that the money is going straight to the small farmer, which is very sad to me. I wish it did. There are so many labels on the front that are bullshit. Look at the label on the back more. Make sure it has the things in it that you need.
If you're at the SciBabe, you can go to scibabe.com to enter the strange, magnificent world.
my little place where I swear and tell dick jokes about science.
And if you have comments, you can send it to yourragefuelsher@scibabe.com.
That works too.
Hey, thanks so much for sharing a perspective and spending a half an hour on the radio. Really good stuff. And we'll send some folks your direction, scibabe.com. Thanks again, Yvette.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, I'll see you back here in a week as we get ready for Halloween and do our annual Ghost Stories broadcast.
Prepare yourself for the ghouls and ghosts and goblins and nights and frights. And the ghost stories of Halloween. We'll do that here next Tuesday night, and I will see you then. Have a great week.
Follow The Thinking Atheist on Facebook and Twitter. Watch dozens of original videos on The Thinking Atheist YouTube channel. And visit our website for resources, links, contact information, the editor's blog, and more. TheThinkingAtheist.com.